Good evening, this is Christine, VK4XTC. This is the Education Hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society. Tonight, Laurie, VK4KST, continues with his fascinating presentation and takes us back in time once again with Part 7 of Halcyon Days. David, VK4TDR, talks to us about Bill Gates, the man behind Microsoft, and of course the Windows operating system. Raf, VK4XRF, repeats part two of his very popular digital mode series due to numerous requests for a rerun. And lastly for tonight, we have another episode of Why Is It So? With Professor Julia Sumner Miller. Tonight the good professor gets very excited and has some fun making bubbles. Please stand by for this evening's program. And now, here is Laurie, VK4KST, presenting Part 7 of Halcyon Days.
Very good evening to you all, and welcome to our journey back in time. The contest calendar during the 1930s lacked the number and variety of events available to the contemporary amateur, but even so, there was enough of this activity to keep the enthusiast busy. Some of the larger societies were already staging yearly tests. The Radio Society of Great Britain organised its first test week in February 1931. This was the beginning of the well-supported international DX competitions in the UK and the forerunner of the many yearly RSGB contests that came into being prior World War II, namely BERU plus separate 80, 40, 15 and 10 metre tests for phone and CW. The WIA and NZART combined in 1935 to stage the first ever VKZL contest. However, a forerunner to this was the Melbourne Centenary International DX Contest. In launching the contest rules in March 1934, issue of Amateur Radio Journal, Bob Cunningham, VK3ML, the contest manager said, "This will be the first time in Australian history that any division or even the federal headquarters of the WIA has staged such an undertaking. We have all been the guests of the W's and the G's often enough, and have thoroughly enjoyed their tests. Now it's our turn to offer one in return." For this first effort, the committee put a lot of forethought into setting out the rules. A section for shortwave listeners was included. A separate test for receiving stations in all parts of the world was provided for, and all were eligible for the awards in that section. This was an encouragement for shortwave listeners to go for their ticket. In 1934, there was keen interest in the newly developing 28 meg band, and to encourage operation in this area, bonus points were given for contact on this band. A lot less was known about this phenomena called the sunspot cycle in those days. The winner was VK3MR Snowy Campbell with 100,320 points. During the years 1934 and 1935, the VK4 division ran a local radio cup contest. It was held early in the year. CW and phone sections held on separate weekends. A gentleman by the name of Bert Bullock, VK4ZX, took his portable gear down to Lotta, 18 kilometres from Brisbane, and although he called all day, was heard by no one. Jack Files, VK4JEF, was more successful on QRP, using 60 volts DC on a C 603 receiving tube operating as a Hartley oscillator. The child protege A1 mode YL operator, Madeline McKenzie VK4YL, consistently put up outstanding scores in the RSGB contests while in her early teens. Her decision to quit amateur radio after World War II was a big loss for the contest scene. Proficient CW operator Jack Bates, VK4UR, worked over 200 W stations during the 1936 ARRL contest. A stout effort, considering the modus operandi at the time. Those who wish to participate with distinction in contests must continually update their equipment, aiming always for a bigger signal. Their operating ability automatically improves, simply because practice makes perfect. Consequently, contesting has been responsible for a significant part of amateur radio's progress. Present-day proof of its popularity can be gauged by the increase in the number of events staged yearly. They total over 100 and originate from all continents. The first universally popular award promoted in the amateur scene was WAC, Worked All Continents. It was introduced in the 1920s, and though generally considered to be the brainchild of the ARRL, it is in reality an International Amateur Radio Union creation. The award can usually be found pinned to the shack wall by those who have any interest in this paper chase. Prior to the war, the RSGB was quick to set up an awards program by issuing a series of proficiency certificates for long-distance DX work. These certificates were based on an empire theme, and all were keenly sought after by members and non-members alike. The pre-World War II amateur had a wide variety of journals and magazines for his perusal, many more than the contemporary reader might imagine. Over 250 appeared at one time or another up to 1939. I'll mention just a couple for interest. QTC, the first magazine published in Australia and the second in the then British Empire, devoted entirely to amateur radio, was produced originally by the Queensland Radio Transmitters League. Volume number one was printed in July 1927. The final publication, volume number 53, in November 1931. Lifespan, 4 years and 6 months. Queensland Radio News, subtitled Your Own Wireless Journal, published by the Reed Press, Brisbane. Volume 1, number 1, appeared in Brisbane on the 2nd of February 1925 and contained 45 pages. It was one of the first local journals of its type and came onto the market approximately 6 months before A and B class medium wave broadcasting commenced. The first issue was free. Subsequent issues cost sixpence. Yearly subscriptions, 6 shillings and 6pence post free, which remained unchanged until the magazine's demise in 1934. This I find quite interesting, I'm sure you will too. It's a small article in Volume 1, Number 1. The wireless license fees are 35 shillings per year within 250 miles of Brisbane, 30 shillings between 250 and 400 miles, 25 shillings in other parts of the state, and after 1 year, these will be reduced by 5 shillings per year. In any free enterprise system, a need very quickly produces a supplier. The introduction of medium wave sound broadcasting created an immediate demand for receiving sets, parts, crystals and valves. Consequently, radio trading houses soon began to appear. Some dealt only in component parts, whereas wireless was only a section of a larger electrical business for other traders. As might be expected, the variety and quantity of gear available was very limited at first, and the pre-1930 amateur and shortwave listener were forced to homebrew their requirements. By the middle of the 1930s, the dearth of equipment was being overcome as trading houses increased in number and the diversity of parts and complete sets increased. Let me tell you about one of the stores, Joe Foster's Radio, and a very interesting story. Joe Foster's Radio, near the corner of Albert and Elizabeth Streets, Brisbane, is a one-man business offering free advice, valve and set testing, and personalised attention, components only. In his day, Joe Foster, sale proprietor of Foster's Radio, could be best described as a portly, smiling, friendly vendor of component parts, a man with a well-developed knack for making a profit. He survived for many years selling low-priced items to the home brewer. From time to time, his shop window contained many enticing gimmicks. One of these was Joe's mystery crystal set coil. This was no mystery at all, but simply an attractive coil wound with bright green DCC copper wire on a shiny black Bakelite former and complete with bright nickel-plated terminals and a base mount. One day a lad entered his shop and inquired, "Do you still have any of those mystery coils for sale?" Joe searched the back room and finally appeared with the last one of his stock. It was soil-stained and dirty. "There," he said, "needs a bit of a clean, but it still works okay and it's cheap. Only 2 shillings. The youth scrutinised the dull and dirty coil. "No thanks," he said finally. "The green cotton covering has lost its colour." Actually, it was only covered with fine grey dust. "Wait," said Joe, sensing a sale was about to be lost. Taking the coil, he retreated to the privacy of the back room. Grabbing a strong bristle brush, he gave the grimy coil a fast hard work over and replaced the tarnished terminals with sparkling new ones. It came up like new. "There," he said to the waiting lad, "the last new one in the shop. Price? 4 shillings. Daunted at the increased cost, and mindful of his very thin wallet, the lad, later to become VK4SS, inquired, "4 shillings, you say?" "Yes," beamed old Joe, anticipating a sale at double the price. "No thanks," said the lad. "I'll take the first one, please." Well, that brings us to the end of our journey. It has been said many times, and can stand repetition, that amateur radio is a natural resource, low-key during peace and order, but assuming a high profile in times of emergency or war. Our self-taught skills, often to professional standard, are continually sought by governments and the commercial world alike, so it is imperative that this respect and need be maintained. It can be very easily lost. The old timers whose names and experiments I've spoken of in this series have indeed demonstrated their worth in war and peace. Those who follow must not fail them. Those willing to conduct genuine experiments deserve to be strongly encouraged. Our destiny will be determined by our attitudes, service, dedication, vigilance, and most important, our willingness to cooperate one with the other. I'm Laurie, VK4KST. I hope you've enjoyed your journey with me back in time. Until next we meet, take care.
Q5 extends our thanks and gratitude to Alan Shaw Smith, VK4SS, for permission to use extracts from his book entitled The Halcyon Days. This is Q5, the education hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.
Please stand by for David, VK4TDR, as he talks to us about Bill Gates, the man behind Microsoft.
Good evening. This is David, VK4TDR. If we are talking creativity and ideas, Bill Gates is an American unoriginal. He is Microsoft's chief and co-founder. He is the world's richest man, and his career delivers this message. It can be wiser to follow than to lead. Let the innovators hit the beaches and take the losses. If you hold back and follow, you can clean up in peace and quiet. Yet we have been unfair to him. Few living Americans have been so resented, envied, and vilified. But in certain ways his career is distinguished by decency, and he hasn't got much credit for it. Technology confuses us, throws us off the scent. Where Gates is concerned, we have barked up a lot of wrong trees. A 1968 photo shows Bill as a rapt young teenager watching his friend Paul Allen type at a computer terminal. Allen became a co-founder of Microsoft. The child Gates, his neat hair and eager, pleasant smile, every last detail says, "Pat me on the head." He entered Harvard, but dropped out to found Microsoft in 1975. Microsoft's first product was a version of the programming language BASIC for the Altair 8800, arguably the world's first personal computer. BASIC, invented by John Kemeny and Thomas Kurtz in 1964, was someone else's idea. So was the Altair. Gates merely plugged one into the other, cream-cheesed the waiting bagel, and came up with a giant hit. By 1980, IBM had decided to build personal computers and needed a PC operating system, as computers are born naked and they need operating systems to be presentable. Mammoth blue-chip IBM employed thousands of capable software builders and didn't trust a single one of them. IBM hired Microsoft to build its operating system. Microsoft bought QDOS from a company called Seattle Computer Products and retailored it for the PC. The PC was released in August 1981 and was followed into the market by huge flocks of honking, beeping clones. Microsoft's DOS was one of the three official PC operating systems, but quickly beat out the other two. DOS was clunky and primitive at a time when the well-dressed computer was wearing Unix from Bell Labs, or, if its tastes ran upscale, some variant of the revolutionary window menu mouse system that Xerox had pioneered in the 1970s. But despite, or maybe because of, its stodginess, DOS established itself as a school uniform of computing. It was homely, but everyone needed it. Once again, Gates had brokered a marriage between other people's ideas and came up with a hit. DOS was even bigger than BASIC. Gates had it made. Apple released the Macintosh in January 1984. A sophisticated computer was now available to the masses. Henceforth, DOS was not merely homely, it was obsolete. But it continued to rake in the money. So what if the critics hated it? In May 1990, Microsoft finally perfected its own version of Apple Windows and called it Microsoft Windows 3.0. Another huge hit. Now Gates really had it made. By the early 90s, electronic mail and the internet were big. Technologists forecast an internet-centered view of computing called mirror worlds. Technophiles enthused about the information superhighway. The World Wide Web emerged in 1994, making browsers necessary, and Netscape was founded that same year. Sun Microsystems developed Java, the Internet programming language, but Gates hung back. It wasn't until 1996 that Microsoft finally, according to Gates himself, embraced the Internet wholeheartedly. Why lead when you can follow? Microsoft's first browser, Internet Explorer 1.0, was licensed from a company called Spyglass. It was an afterthought, available off the shelf as part of a $45 CD-ROM, crammed with random tidbits, software antipasto, odds and ends you could live without, one of which was Explorer. Today Microsoft is the world's most powerful supplier of web browsers, and Gates really has it made. The world pondered Gates and assumed he must be a great thinker. During World War II, cargo cults flourished on New Guinea and Melanesia. People who had never seen an airplane pondered incoming US aircraft and assumed they must be divine. Technology is confusing, and these were reasonable guesses under the circumstances. In 1995, Gates published a book called The Road Ahead. Peering far into the future, he glimpsed a technology-rich dream world where you will be able to watch Gone with the Wind, he wrote, with your own face and voice replacing Vivian Leigh's or Clark Gable's. Apparently this is just what the public had been dying to do, for The Road Ahead became a runaway bestseller. And yet we tend to overlook, in sizing him up, Gates's basic decency. He has repeatedly been offered a starring role in the circus freak show of American celebrity, but he has turned it down. He does not make a habit of going on TV to pontificate, free associate or share his feelings. His wife and young children are largely invisible to the public, which represents a deliberate decision on the part of Mr. and Mrs. If post-war America of the 1950s and 60s democratized middle-classness, Gates has democratized filthy richness, or has at least started to. Get the right job offer from Microsoft, work hard, get rich, no miracle required. Key Microsoft employees pushed Gates in this direction, but he was willing to go, and the industry followed. The Gates Road to Wealth is still a one-laner, and traffic is limited. But the idea that a successful corporation should enrich not merely its executives and big stockholders, but also a fair number of ordinary line employees, although not unique to Microsoft, is potentially revolutionary. Wealth is good, and Gates has created lots and has also been willing to share. Today, Gates, grown very powerful and great, sits at the centre of world technology, like an immense frog eyeing insect life on the pond's surface, now and then consuming a tasty company with one quick dart of the tongue. But the Microsoft Windows worldview is dead in the water, and Microsoft has nothing to offer in its place. Windows is a relic of the ancient days when email didn't matter, when the internet and the web didn't matter, when most computer users had only a relative handful of files to manage. Big changes are in the works that will demote computers and their operating systems to the status of TV sets. You can walk up to any TV and tune in CBS. You will be able to walk up to any computer and tune in your own files, your electronic life. The questions of the moment are, what will the screen look like? How will the controls work? What exactly will they do? And who will clean up? Microsoft? Maybe. On the other hand, being the biggest, toughest frog in the pond doesn't help if you're in the wrong pond. Some people have the idea that Microsoft is fated to dominate technology forever. They had the same idea about IBM, once admired and feared nearly as much as Microsoft is today. They had essentially the same idea about Japan's technology sector back in the 1980s and early 1990s. It isn't quite fair to compare Microsoft to a large country yet, but Japan was on a roll and looked invincible once. As for Gates himself, he is no visionary. He is a technology groupie with a genius for showing up, for being at the right place at the right time. His secret is revealed in that old photo with Paul Allen. He is a man who likes computers very much. Not their intellectual underpinnings, not the physics or electronics, not the art or philosophy or mathematics or software. Just plain computers. He's crazy about them. It seems like an odd passion, but after all, some people are crazy about Pop-Tarts. And Gates will be remembered alongside Pop-Tarts in the long run as vintage Americana, a sign of the times. A little on the bland side, perhaps, unexciting, not awfully deep, not to everyone's taste, but not all that bad. Well, that's all from me this evening. This is VK4TDR.
Q5 is a production of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.
Coming up next, RAF VK4XRF brings us part two of the digital modes and their sounds, repeated by popular demand.
Greetings. Continuing from last week's discussion on digital modes, I have some more examples of the strange, weird and wonderful sounds you might encounter on both HF and the VHF and UHF bands. Firstly, I have some examples of navigation and beacon signals. This is the sound of a non-directional beacon, or NDB. And here is an example of a system called LORAN, or Long Range Radio Navigation System. It sounds like this. Another type of radio navigation system is called HyperFix. That stands for Hyperbolic Radio Navigation System. It sounds like this. It is mostly used by the military. Then we have DECA. a HF radio navigation system that sounds like this. Turning now to digital modes used by amateurs, we have a popular mode used on HF that only uses 31 Hz of bandwidth. It is called PSK31, and it sounds like this. It is becoming very popular as it provides highly readable text using low power, low bandwidth, and over great distances. PSK31 is based on an idea by SP9VRC and developed by Peter Martinez, G3PLX, who also developed mTOR. Based on RTTY, PSK is used for live keyboard-to-keyboard QSOs at 50 words per minute or 31 baud and uses phase shift keying to signal mark and space values instead of changing the frequency like RTTY does, which is called FSK. DSP, or Digital Signal Processing, is used to change the phase by 180 degrees when a switch from mark to space is needed. DSP analysis by the program instantly detects this phase shift. PSK works in a very narrow bandwidth, which sharply reduces noise and QRM. This narrow signal also makes it excellent for QRP low power modes, with between 5 and 10 watts producing excellent intercontinental paths. Another interesting mode is called MFSK, which sounds like this. MFSK is a technique for transmitting digital data using multiple tones, extending the RTTY two-tone technique to many tones, usually but not always one tone at a time. MFSK means multi-frequency shift keying and should not be confused with MSK, which is minimum shift keying. There are a number of different techniques using concurrent or parallel tones, sequential, one after another, tones, and combinations of tones. MT-HEL can either be concurrent or sequential. DTMF tones used for telephone signalling are concurrent tone pairs, while piccolo and coquelet, although using tone pairs, are decidedly sequential. MFSK transmissions have a unique sound, which is almost musical, which is why piccolo and coquelet received their names. Coquelet means rooster. You may have heard of Hellschreiber. It sounds like this. Hellschreiber was patented in 1929 and is still in use today using the original format. Hellschreiber was the first successful direct printing text transmission system and was very popular at a time when teleprinters were complex and expensive. The Hell receiving mechanism had only two moving parts. At first, the Hellschreiber was mostly used for landline press services, which continued well into the 1980s. A military version was used by the German Condor Legion during the Spanish Civil War in 1933. During World War II, Hellschreiber was widely used for field portable military communications, for which it proved to be very suitable because the equipment was simple and robust. Today, we use the term Field Hell or Feld Hell for this system to help differentiate it from the slightly different landline press systems. Each character of a Feldhell transmission is portrayed as a series of dots in a matrix, just like the printing of a dot matrix printer. The dots are sent one at a time, rather like Morse code. Feldhell transmits in the following order, up each column from bottom to top, then up each successive column from left to right. If you scan around on the VHF and UHF bands, you will find many examples of digital modes there too. Some of them sound decidedly odd. You may be quite familiar with this sound. I will tell you what that one is later. You should know the answer to that one. It's a pretty common sound. Here is an interesting digital mode you can decode quite easily at home with a simple bit of software using your computer's sound card. It is called ACARS, Aircraft Communication and Reporting System, It is used to transmit aircraft waypoint, temperature, performance, and other data between to and from the ground station. Here is an example of ACARS. And lastly for tonight, I have some examples of voice encryption from simple inversion. To digital encryption as used by the police. To military examples. That one was called KY57, and this one is a Racal Cougar system as used by special law enforcement units and the military. Incidentally, many of the amateur digital modes that I've spoken about can be decoded and transmitted by a software package called MixW2. You can download your own demo copy of MixW2 from many sites on the internet. Just do a search using your favourite search engine such as Google. The version I downloaded recently, for example, is about 2 megabytes in size, but it's spelt MIXW2. It shouldn't be too hard to find. Oh, and the sound that you should have been able to guess, well, that was pagers. We've heard a fair bit of that lately, so anyway, goodbye until next week.
Lastly for tonight, we have another episode of Why Is It So? With good Professor Julia Sumner Miller. Tonight he is having fun making bubbles.
Now I have some special soap solution in this vessel here, and here's a frame that's about what? 9 inches in diameter. Step back a little, if you will. Good. Watch it now. Watch. Do you see I have? Notice the high elastic property of that surface, Mr. Harris. Oh, look. Now watch. Oh, what shape is that? Spherical. Now watch. Oh, I lost that one. There we are. Look at that. Isn't that terrific? Look at that. And look at the colors. So I must remind you, Felix, the colors of the rainbow due to interference and refraction in selective absorption. Do you see how much optics there is in this subject? Yes. Remember, who discovered the nature of white light? Who? Who? Oh, you trouble me in my little belly. Isaac Newton. In the year 1665, I procured me a triangular glass prism with which to try the celebrated phenomena of colors. And for this purpose, I cut me a slit in my window shut to let in an appropriate measure of the sun's light. Then the light fell on the prism, and then on the yonder wall, he saw red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet. And what did he say? It was at first a pretty divertisement. See, an interesting thing. But then when I began to examine it more circumspectly, and thus was born his theory of light. Well, let me make some more. Do you see how wonderful it is to know what these men said about their work? And of all the things that Isaac Newton did, invented the calculus, discovered the law of gravitation, the laws of motion of mechanics, the nature of white light. What do you think? Oh, invented the calculus. I said that, yes. What did he think was his greatest achievement? Discovering the nature of white light. By all means, he said, by all means. I've forgotten the exact words now. I'm a little pressed for that. Yes. The most profound of all the operations of nature. So when you go outside and you see the sunlight, which looks white, what color is it really? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet.
Yeah.
Right, so go read a biography of Newton. Watch it now. There's one. Oh, there's another. Look at, oh, I nearly had two. Look at that. Isn't that terrific? Isn't that wonderful? Look at that. So, there's a good one. And notice, as long as I can keep it rotating a little bit about some axis, it will aid its stability. Look at that. Look at that. Gone. There's a good one. Notice, however much it rotates, gentlemen, and however much it gets deformed, does it not always end up how? Spherical. 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 Yes. And I'm going to make one more. Why, Mr. Felix, am I going to make one more? I'm having fun with it, Mr. Harris. He shouldn't be a week in coming up with an answer. There is one more. Two more. Smaller ones. Yes. And I say, this is wonderful to think about. Let me get...
Q5 is a production of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society. Some materials used in the program may be copyright to the respective authors. Would you like to become a radio amateur? If you would, then the Radio and Electronics School has a course for you. You have been listening to Q5, the Education Hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.